You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. A Coast Guard fact-finding hearing on the ship crash that collapsed a portion of the Eggner's Ferry Bridge wrapped up Friday. Throughout the week, we've heard from state highway officials, Coast Guard officials, employees of Foss Maritime, which own and operate the Delta Mariner, and the ship's pilot. Casey Northcutt has been covering these hearings for WKMS. She joins me to talk about Friday's testimony and the overall outcomes of the week-long hearing. Casey, let's first talk about testimony from pilot Michael Collins. First, explain the terms of his employment with Foss.
Michael Collins is an independent river pilot contracted by the Foss Maritime Company as a pilot advisor. He is not a Foss Maritime employee, and he merely advises the crew how to navigate. He was not at the helm during the accident, but he was giving directions. Strangely enough, Foss does not have a written contract with Collins. Foss Senior Vice President of Operations Scott Merritt told me that it's common practice for river pilots not to have written contracts. They have been assisting ships up and down the river system since before Mark Twain's time.
So what is pilot Collins' background then?
Collins has 36 years of maritime experience and several licenses, including certificates from the Seamen's Church Institute. He has piloted the Delta Mariner through the Eggner's Ferry Bridge 5 times.
Yesterday, the captain of the ship said he made a suggestion just a few minutes before impact that if the boat needed to turn around or stop, that, quote, now would be the time to avoid impact with the bridge. Pilot Collins didn't take his advice. Why not?
Collins believed it was already too late to turn around.
Does Pilot Collins assume blame for the accident?
No, he does not. He said a couple of times that he believed that the lights fooled him, or he was fooled by the lights.
And did they get into the details associated why he wasn't aware of the lighting issues that were on the bridge?
He understood that the bridge did not have proper lighting. He knew there were supposed to be 3 white lights on the main span. As far as everyone has testified, no one who gave testimony during the investigation knew about the notice to mariners that said that the lights were out on the Eggner's Ferry Bridge. Somehow they missed that. So what Pilot Collins understood was that there weren't lights on the main span for some reason, and he thought that he was steering the boat into the channel adjacent to the main span, which he says that river pilots transit all the time, and they do it safely. And so he also said that he could transit a boat through an unlit span, but it was easier to transit through a lit span. So that's what he was aiming for.
Did Pilot Collins commit any egregious errors, according to the Coast Guard?
To some extent, that's a matter of opinion. Officials asked a lot of questions about why Collins didn't use certain pieces of equipment and navigational guides, like sailing lines, for instance. Like a sailing line, for instance. And he replied that the sailing line wasn't always accurate and that he didn't check other navigational tools because he believed he knew which span he was transiting until too late. So they asked pointed questions. It really depends on your point of view, honestly.
So what's next then, now that these hearings are over?
The investigative body will take this information and go through evidence and testimony for the next several months before they file a report on the causes.
And then have you talked to any legal counsel or representatives from Foss or the Highway Department to see how this may affect any further legal action related to the crash?
Representatives were vague on legal actions that will be taken, but Sonny Smith, an attorney for the Transportation Cabinet, said the findings and the report from this hearing will not be admissible in court.
Casey, you had a chance to catch up with Scott Merritt, a VP with Foss Maritime. Did you find out anything about the future employment of any of these mariners that were on the ship the night that it crashed?
A couple of the crew members who were called to testify in this investigation have by choice left Foss Maritime Company. Everyone else is still employed.
Did he mention anything about contracting with Pilot Collins again?
He said that was not up to him.
Okay, Casey Northcutt, thanks very much for your time covering these hearings this week.
Thank you.
There's a hole in the river where my
Construction on the Olmsted Lock and Dam project in southern Illinois has been ongoing for 20 years, 13 years over schedule. Now a completion date is set for 2026. Shelley Baskin spoke with project engineer Richard Shipp on the problems plaguing the project and what lies ahead for the site.
The Olmsted Dam project has been experiencing a lot of cost overruns and delays since its construction started, and I understand that they're starting a review process for it. What all will be a part of this review process?
The Corps is looking at all options, to be quite honest. We're looking at construction methods, and as some of you may know, we're building the dam in a, what we call an in-the-wet methodology in lieu of the coffer dams. We are revisiting that decision and looking at whether it's possible to go back to an in-the-dry method, if that would be cheaper or faster. So that's currently under review. We're looking at contracting techniques. By that I mean the acquisition strategies for these contracts. Generally, the Corps works in a firm fixed price contracting arrangement. Well, due to the risk on the dam and the nature of the river in this area, we did not get any bidders when we went out on their firm fixed price and had to go cost reimbursable. We're looking at our management approach, we have sent people to other large projects to look at how they're managing the projects. Are they doing anything different than we're doing so we can bring those lessons back? We're looking at all the processes and procedures that this office has employed to run a cost reimbursement project. We brought in independent consultants from outside the government to look at a lot of these things and make sure that we're doing them, meeting our requirements and our regulations, and if there's anything they have to offer. So basically, we're looking at all options. We owe that to the taxpayer and to the customer, and that's what we're doing.
And major construction projects are going to have a lot of cost overruns and delays, but this one seems to have more than most. What exactly has been the cause of this project's problems?
Well, there's a multitude of reasons behind it. Certainly, the river in this area is very dynamic. It fluctuates annually somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 45 feet. And anytime you work in the river in those conditions, it's a challenge. And that would be whether you build this with, say, in the wet technology or with a coffer dam or whatever. We had extreme challenges when we built the coffer dam for the lock. So the river is one factor. One of the other major factors is funding. We do not get funding to build the project as efficiently as we would like to be able to build it. We do not buy all the materials we want to buy at one time because we're getting funded on a monthly basis. So you look at how much money you've got left over to apply and how much you're getting next month to go out and buy more equipment, more materials, and that sort of thing. So that's had a major impact on the project. And I think we're recognizing also that the in-the-wet methodology is certainly more costly than what we thought when we made those decisions years ago. So we're recognizing that. But all those factors have played into it.
So is this month-to-month funding schedule a normal part of these types of projects?
Oh, it's not normal. The funding for this project comes from two sources, one source being the federal government and second source being the Inland Waterways Trust Fund, which is a tax placed on the diesel fuel of the towing industry. And that account gets money into it every month, and those funds are then sent out. And, there's not a large surplus there to fund any project over a long period of time. So that's one of the major contributors right now. And certainly, funding has been a challenge.
What's the most recent estimate for how much this is going to cost taxpayers?
Well, when we say dam, we need to make sure we understand the terminology. We report the cost for the total project. That includes all previous completed projects, plus the dam, plus the future projects of removing 52 and 53 and some operational facilities and some equipment. So right now, we're projecting a total cost for the entire project of $2.9 billion.
So once all is said and done on this project and it opens up for use, will the cost of the project be worth the rewards from it?
This project provides a significant benefit to this nation. The annual benefits are estimated at $741 million per year. And that's a combination of increased traffic flow, reduced locking times, reduced maintenance, fewer delays and outages. You know, and all in all, that's a savings that the American public will see in their transportation costs. And in spite of significant cost overruns at $741 million a year, in 4 years, the project still pays for itself. So it's a significant benefit to the nation.
Richard, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Richard Shipp is the project engineer of the Olmsted Lock and Dam Project. When we come back, we'll meet running guru Jeff Galloway, who hosted a running clinic here in Murray this past week. And we'll also meet Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. They perform on Murray State's campus this coming week. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Murray hosted its second annual half marathon and 5K this weekend. And once again, organizers asked world-class runner and former Olympian Jeff Galloway to come and host a free running clinic prior to the race. Galloway is a regular contributor to Runner's World, an author of more than 15 books on the subject, and has coached more than 20,000 runners through his Galloway Marathon training program. Drew Adams spoke to Jeff prior to the race about his running, his teaching methods, and an injury which has slowed the marathoner's pace, if only for a time.
What I encountered last year, and actually do at all of these schools around the country, is solve problems and calm people down and let them realize that they have control in almost every case over whether they're going to get extremely fatigued or get aches and pains or whatever. My run-walk-run method is really what has taken the sting out of doing these events and has opened it up to practically everybody. So that's the cornerstone of what I'll be teaching.
Do you ever end up teaching people who maybe have never run?
About 30% of the folks that enter our programs are just getting started. And then we have about 10% who are really focused on competitive goals. But the other folks in between have their ups and downs. A lot of folks who are not runners or, have dropped out of running think that everybody is motivated as a runner, and that's not true at all. And that's where my role is, because I've come up with a number of these techniques that can keep people focused in the conscious brain and then helping them when there are challenges to get through them based on things that have worked thousands of times.
Now, what are some more of these kind of common problems that you run across at these kind of events?
Motivation. Now, I don't know anybody who doesn't go through lulls in motivation, but my role is to explain why that happens and then to give tools as to how you can turn it around. And it really came about just counseling people in these schools over the last 40 years and figuring out what types of techniques and mental training work. But last year, I came out with a book called Mental Training, and I went into the research on how the brain operates and discovered some really mind-expanding tools that will allow people to keep away from generating the negative hormones and turn it around through mental training so that you can stay positive, stay on track, and then push through barriers when they come up.
Can you tell me maybe one of those tools or one of the ones that kind of surprised you?
Yes. The biggest breakthrough was to understand the major components of the brain that govern most of what we do. One of them is the subconscious brain that I call the reflex brain, because it has pre-programmed stimulus response behavior patterns, thousands of them embedded, and it subconsciously conducts all the things that we take for granted, such as our hearts beating, the blood flowing, breathing, and then all these other things that we have trained ourselves to do. One of the primitive aspects of this subconscious brain is the way it handles stress, which is not good. And that is, when the stress level builds up to what it deems to be a little too high, it starts shutting things down. It will secrete anxiety hormones, and then if you persist in building up some more stress, it'll produce some negative attitude hormones. And the more stress you're under, the more negative you're going to tend to get. The secret and the methods that I talk about are not based on doing away with the stress. I mean, that'd be nice, but most of us can't do that. It's based on shifting control into the conscious human brain. In that brain, which is the executive brain, you can set up plans of action that keep you focused and stop the production of the negative attitude hormones. So the conscious brain can override the subconscious brain. And as a result of a method, you can move yourself from not being motivated and feeling somewhat depressed about what you're doing to, I can't believe how good I feel.
And does the physical play part in this? I'm thinking of the like the walk portion of your training regimen. Do you need that physical stop in order to kind of let your brain dial it back?
Yes, you've identified one of the positive aspects, the taking a break so that you're not continuously building up that stress from running and the chance to think, you know, while you're taking a walk break. But the other major aspect of it is running produces the most powerful positive attitude hormones that we can produce, and those are beta endorphins. When we're running continuously, they have to really kill the pain of running. But when we're walking, there's no running pain to kill, and therefore they lock into the receptor sites all over the body and give you a feeling of confidence and good feelings about what you're doing and a positive attitude.
Have you seen a difference in your race times as a result of run-walking?
One of the challenges I had, I just a few weeks ago was walking up a set of stairs and didn't look at the last step, tripped over it, landed on my hip, and got a fracture of my hip. I won't be able to run this year. I'll just be running my mouth all weekend. But first time in 35 years that I hadn't been able to run every day.
How's that affected you thus far?
No, a case in point. I'm not getting those great doses of positive attitude hormones, and I simply do not feel as good throughout the day as I used to feel. And I'm okay. You know, I'm not depressed or anything. It's just I know what it's like to be on your game and feeling good due to the endorphins, and I know that I'm not getting that. I'm looking forward to the time in a few weeks when I'll be back out there, because I will.
So being that you've run for so long, how do you plan to combat kind of not being able to have that endorphin rush you've had for so long now that you've hurt yourself?
The advantage of having run that long and having had setbacks earlier in my running career when I was younger and pushed it harder and then had lingering time off for it, I know that, you get these initial feelings that you'll never be back running. But knowing what I know now, about counseling tens of thousands of people who've been through similar situations and hearing from them that they're back and they're running as strong as ever, I know I'm going to be back. That's just not a question. So now I'm really applying myself to working with others, as I do at any time. But it's really very fulfilling to solve the problems and get them motivated, get them back on their way when they've had a setback.
Drew Adams spoke with runner and former Olympian Jeff Galloway. Galloway hosted his second running clinic just prior to Murray's second annual half marathon and 5K run this weekend. Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds play Murray State's Love It Live on Stage concert series Tuesday night at 7:30 in Love It Auditorium. Beyond the Edge host Tracy Ross and Love It Live host Matt Parker recently spoke with lead singer Arlie Kinchlow about growing up in the Catskills, creating music with nine musicians, and the band's very generous fan base.
Arlie, let's start from the roots a little bit. You guys grew up in the Catskill Mountains, correct?
Yes, my brother Jackson and I did grow up in the Catskills. That's where my dad moved the family over from San Francisco after they had their first three kids. So I'm the youngest of four, and I'm the only Yankee of all of them. So
how does growing up in the Catskills, how does that affect you as a writer? Is there any part of what you do as a band now that you carry over from how you grew up and the music that you were around then?
That's a great question. I think that because my parents are both from different places. My mom's from California originally, and my dad moved around a bit, but he was originally from Pittsburgh, but they lived in San Francisco together, like I said. So I think, you know, their musical interests were my, you know, biggest influences. They are both musicians themselves. So growing up in the Catskills was just a good setting for sort of a rich background, I think, that my parents wanted to pass on to us, and with a lot of different influences. And so we have that eclectic vibe. But, you know, I think that the thing that, you know, most influenced me from living up there was trying to value the family vibe. And we definitely do that within the band.
You play with your brother and your cousin as well, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, our cousin is the drummer, Bram. My father has an identical twin brother, and Bram is George's son. So we're sort of, we look a lot alike because our fathers are twins, you know.
You've been compared as a vocalist to the likes of Adele and Amy Winehouse, and I could probably name several others. Are you happy about these comparisons, or do you feel constricted?
I'm definitely always very flattered and grateful to hear any comparison to any great singer. And I don't feel pinned down, because I think people just like to have comparisons, you know, to make things make sense. You know what I mean? So it's like I can be sort of grouped in with some singers like that, or sometimes I get the opposite. You know, I mean, people said Janis Joplin a lot, but it's like, which is sort of a wildly different vibe than those other that you mentioned. I like it. It's fine. You know, I think it's cool that people think I'm good at all, you know. So it's always nice to hear.
Writing music with a group of 9 people, I try to imagine that, and that seems difficult. To you, is that a beneficial byproduct of having 9 people? Do you feel like you can pull more by writing that way, or does it ever feel like maybe it's too many cooks in the kitchen?
Well, the way it works for us is I bring in the lyrics and the idea for the song and the structure of it and a lot of, like, some of the chord changes, and then we sort of arrange it all together. So in that way, it makes it easier because I already have an idea formed for, you know, what I'm thinking and how I might want it to sound. But it is really great to be able to pick everybody's brains about what they think, and everybody adds their 2 cents and puts themselves into the writing of it as well, you know, with the horn parts and then the flavor of the guitar and the harmonica and, you know, right down to the bass lines and the rhythm. It's, everyone really just puts their own personality into it. So it works really well, surprisingly, you know. I mean, we get stuff done pretty quickly, which is a relief, to say the least. So
it's truly strength in numbers for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
USA Today picked one of your songs, Make It Rain, as one of their USA Today playlist picks. Do you feel like this is a moment for your band to make a leap as far as national recognition? Is this a big deal for you to have a song featured in USA Today?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think any national recognition at all is always a big deal, and every little bit helps, you know. But I think the way we're sort of attacking this country is just by going forth and visiting all these towns and sort of spreading it around in a sort of grassroots way. So I think anything that we get, like USA Today or something like that, that sort of helps us connect the dots at all is amazing. And super grateful and excited that happened, for sure.
Let me ask you about your relationship with your fans. I've noticed your Kickstarter fundraiser campaign, and it looks like you've achieved your goal, right? You actually got your fans to buy a new tour bus for you, right? Or a tour van.
Yeah, it's amazing. We reached our goal, you know, with a couple of days to spare. We actually went a little bit over, which was amazing. It's really heartwarming, and it makes us feel like we're doing the right thing and making the right kind of music for the right kind of people. And these fans are the reason why we're out here, and, you know, that's why we do it. And if I think personally, like, if it warms my heart, for sure.
Describe the live experience of Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds for us.
Oh, well, it's very high energy. I especially do a lot of dancing. during this show, and obviously hope that other people want to join me in that. And it, yeah, it's very, you know, very fun. It gets sweaty. It's, positive music. You know, we're all having a great time while we're doing it. I think a lot of experiences, you know, you can sort of expect to sort of let loose and, you know, get down a little bit and just have a good time, you know.
Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds play Murray State's Love It Live Onstage Concert Series Tuesday night at 7:30 in Love It Auditorium. Tickets are $12 and are available at the CFSB Center box office or at Ticketmaster.com. Tickets will also be available at the door. For more information, call 270-809-3000. When we come back, Chad Lampe looks back at the past year for the Paducah Symphony Orchestra with its new executive director, Daniel Seen, and artistic director, Raffaella Ponte. We'll also get some pointers on how to brush up on our writing. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. If you've ever driven down the highway and spotted a sign with a misplaced apostrophe or seen syntax so teeth-grindingly bad you almost ran off the road, then this next commentary will be music to your ears. Darlene Mazzone tells us that, for her, writing is every bit the art form, one all the more beautiful when the grammar is good.
Call me old. No, wait, don't call me old. Call me a grammatical geek or a literary Luddite. Oh, call me a wordsmith who chooses to use the purest linguistic alloys. Yes. I give you permission to call me names because I am appalled at the destruction I see by way of the murder in the first degree of our once noble language. First book recommendation: Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. The title of the book is an amphibology, a verbal fallacy arising from an ambiguous grammatical construction and derived from a joke on bad punctuation. To wit, a panda walks into a cafe. He orders a sandwich, eats it, then draws a gun and proceeds to fire at the other patrons. "Why?" asks the surviving waiter amidst the carnage as the panda makes toward the exit. The panda produces a badly punctuated wildlife manual and tosses it over his shoulder. "Well, I'm a panda," he says at the door. "Look it up." The waiter turns to the relevant entry in the manual and, sure enough, finds an explanation. Quote, "Panda, large black and white bear-like mammal native to China. Eats, comma, shoots and leaves." I'll give you a minute to figure that out. The author touches on varied aspects of the history of punctuation and includes many anecdotes, which add another dimension to her explanation of grammatical rules. In the book's final chapter, she opines on the importance of maintaining punctuation rules and addresses the damaging effects of email and the internet on language. Yeah, I can see your eyes rolling as I speak. Trust me, it's not your fifth grade grammar guide. It's a witty, funny, yet salient commentary on how we communicate. Or not. I have this one associate who never capitalizes anything in his attempts to send me a coherent email. I have one who separates his thoughts with a series of dots in every email. And then there are the ubiquitous airwave abbreviations being employed by those who choose to limit their cogent expressions to no more than 140 characters. Second book recommendation, Strictly Speaking by Edwin Newman. Okay, now you can call me old. Mr. Newman was my journalistic hero when I was but a young girl in the throes of those heady days here at MSU. We were all setting out to make our mark on the well-written pages of history as journalism students. Mr. Newman would no doubt be spinning in a virtual vortex in his grave if he could see the devastation being wrought upon his beloved English language. When Newman published his bestseller, Strictly Speaking, a blurb on the back cover quoted a reviewer who described the erudite author as, quote, a glass of chilled wine awash in a sea of tepid tab. His book made even the careful writer to stop and think about what cliches he was writing. Granted, a difficult task for a news person on deadline or even a journalist with time to spare. I emphasize thinking in the previous comments because it's partly our race to the finish line these days which engenders the rampant dismissal of all things grammatically correct. When the typewriter was invented and we no longer had to labor with quill and ink over parchment, did we abandon all adherence to careful construction and artful composition simply because the words came faster? Just because we're using a new mode of transmittal does not preclude us from the ability to fashion actual sentences, which provide clarity, meaning, and dare I say it, interesting and captivating conversation on our pages, screens, phones, pads, or whatever receptacles we may be employing at the time. When we as journalism students were encouraged to write with abandon, it did not mean to abandon all the conventions which makes language understandable and eloquent. I take some liberties at times, yes. It's part of the art of writing. But consider this. In the words of the Dalai Lama, know the rules well so you can break them effectively.
Darlene Mazzone is president of Mazzone Communications in Paducah. Opinions expressed in commentaries don't necessarily reflect those of WKMS, but if you'd like to hear this or any of our commentaries again, you can find them at news.wkms.org.
Paperback writer.
It's been about 8 months since the Paducah Symphony Orchestra has been under the watch of new executive director Daniel Scene. Not too long before Scene's arrival came artistic director and conductor Maestro Rafael Ponti. They are rounding out their first season together. They're here in the studio to talk about the PSO and their history and the future of the orchestra. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Hi, Chad.
Many believe that you two had worked together before coming to the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, but I've found out now that that's not the case.
No, that's not the case. Daniel's been a nice addition this season, being his first season here with the PSO, and it's been a wonderful collaboration.
Yeah, I think our chemistry, maybe that's what led people to believe that we seem to be working well right from the start. So it's been good so far.
So we interviewed both of you not too long after you agreed to work with the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, and your agendas were really quite similar, even though neither of you had talked. Both of you had mentioned the common word was growth. Now, Maestro Ponti, what was your vision for the PSO when you started 2 years ago?
My vision with the PSO remains the same, and it's the same with any orchestra that I work with. It's simply to raise the artistic level of the orchestra, and everything else cascades from that. Audience growth, development, programming, programs, and I certainly feel that we began that 2 seasons ago, my first year, but it has excelled itself with Daniel's help this year. You mentioned, Chad, quickly about the idea our comments and ideas are similar. We went through an extensive search when we were looking for an executive director, and when Daniel rose quickly to the top of the pile, his ideas and visions were aligned with what we wanted to do and what I wanted to do with the orchestra. And it's a perfect marriage between what we do together, although we do totally different things. It's a great compliment. He supports the arts and makes it happen. I have these dreams that become reality with his efforts.
And so to be clear, your role is the artistic director. So the things that we see on stage relating to the performance and to the design of the performance come from you. And Daniel, you back that up with whatever needs that he may have.
Absolutely. And in fact, his vision extends beyond the concert hall and through many efforts in the community with our music education efforts and some of the community engagement initiatives that he started and really spearheaded and said, this is one of the ways that we are going to be able to connect with our community better is to get out into the community and help them understand and appreciate and realize that there's a great orchestra here.
So, Raphael, what have you done thus far to advance your vision to grow the artistic value and all of the things that would kind of fall in behind that?
Well, you know, every time a conductor gets up, it's a funny thing because what we do I can't really describe because it's a wordless art and just simply done by gestures. It just becomes so clear to me. You could have the same symphony be performed 10 times with 10 different conductors in the same evening. And it would be the same orchestra playing it differently 10 times. It's just something about that. I have a sound and an idea in my head. And the orchestra, I have to tell you, I am so proud of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra. It is a jewel of an orchestra. And I tell Daniel and everywhere we go about this because we have an all-star personnel. We have players who come from 5 states to play in this orchestra. And the waiting list is becoming quite long. And I'm excited about that because the quality is so good. Because of that, the audience appreciates it. But I can't say enough, you know, I have the ideas, I have these artistic visions, and I'm adamant about them, and I like to throw things on the table. Daniel is the one who makes them come to life. Otherwise, it's just a dream for me.
And Daniel, one of your goals that you mentioned in your interview at WKMS back before you took the job officially, or I know it was on your first day on the job is when we spoke with you, that you wanted to make the PSO more relevant. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of the – Raffaella and I had spoke prior to my being offered the job and then obviously since then. And that's what really sparked my interest in the needs that he was communicating to me at the time made me realize that I could be a good support in that role. And when I mean relevance, I mean being able to get into the community and showing that we're not just an orchestra that comes here and just plays in the concert hall. That as a conductor, he's here for those 7 weeks, and then in addition to that, here at other times as well, we're keeping him busy in the community, actually at his request. And he finds, if we don't keep him busy enough, he finds other things to keep himself busy while he's here as well. So he goes we make it a priority to make sure he's scheduled to go into schools and work with all age ranges of school children. And, you know, he can tell you a little bit more about how he works with, I think, even kindergartners or first grade, second grade.
I give it to you. I'm spending more time in school now, Chad, than when I was supposed to be. But I really enjoy it. Now as a father, I have a 12-year-old violin player, and it's changed my whole focus that it's about turning on these kids of the possibilities. And through music, you know, if people are just looking at it like sound and instruments or singing in a choir, a band, or an orchestra, they're missing the picture because we can teach every skill, every discipline through music, but we can go beyond that. We can teach life skills about how to be your best, how to present yourself, how to prepare, how to have the discipline to study and prepare for your job someday or just for schoolwork or your day, and to see their eyes just open up of the possibilities. And it's all through music.
Now, Daniel, you answer to a board.
Yeah, we have a board of directors of 34, so
it's a lot of bosses.
A lot of personalities to interact with, but you know, they all bring uniqueness to the table. And I've told folks I'm fans of big boards, I'm fans of small boards, as long as people are engaged and working hard at what they're doing. And Raffaele mentioned like our education committee and some of the other committees that we have working, development committee, which of course a pretty significant one. The one that I probably work with closely is development, more so to raise the funds. And you know, they're all working very hard to make sure that this orchestra succeeds and continues to thrive beyond its 32-year history now.
Well, how would you say that the PSO board now defines success in the symphony's current state?
Well, first of all, ending the year in the black is always a very a very good indicator. And actually this year, I'm pleased that that's looking like it's going to be a reality for the first time in several years. And, you know, not by any stroke of genius, but just some good alignment of some stars that have happened and some good energy, as Raffaele had talked about. I think long-term success is still in development. We're still working on that, and I think they're trying to develop that in conjunction with Raffaele's time here with the symphony, and obviously he's brought a lot of excitement and energy. We have a very small amount started in an endowment fund that we'd like to start a campaign in earnest, but for now, in our purposes in evaluating things, we're not at a juncture where we want to launch a large campaign just yet. In fact, this year, if anything, we've started is a new underwriting project that really addresses our core structural deficit issues.
And what are those deficit issues?
The fact of the matter is that none of our concerts are underwritten sufficiently. That's really what we've discovered this year in particular, or at least, you know, revealed. And so this underwriting project really addresses that. It's saying, instead of raising, $50,000, say, for concert sponsorships throughout a season, we're going to need to raise $120,000. And we can do that not just by going back to the same wells, and yes, those are important folks to revisit, but also expanding that donor pool and working with our private individuals better and communicating our vision and Raffaele's vision for the orchestra and the community. And, getting back to that word relevant, making sure people recognize that we're an integral part to the fabric of the community, and not just the community of Paducah, McCracken County, but the entire region. And in fact, we are starting to use the tagline more, we're the region's only professional orchestra. And that's always been true, but no one really understands that between Nashville, Memphis, St. Louis, and now Cincinnati, we're really the region's only professional orchestra. There are some others out there, but they're not quite the same brand as what we're putting out there.
Let's talk about, just growing your audience, growing the excitement level within the audience, and that has to do with your choice in music, Raffaele, and how do you go through the process of developing a concert?
Well, I have to think seasonally. I think from September to April, there has to be something on that menu in the season for everyone, and there has to be a balance of things. I mean, you can't do all Mozart all season long. I mean, it's just flat. It's not enough there. And you can't do all Mahler either. So there has to be a seasonal schedule and a plan, so there's a diet that we fill everybody's musical needs. But then there also has to be a musical layout from the beginning of the concert to the end. And I think, like Daniel's mentioned, my philosophy is the music will live forever. The presentation needs to be updated. And the concert experience has to be changed to become more like what our lives are suited for now, or the pace of life. And I think we're doing that. I think from the moment they park their car, you walk into that lobby, there's things happening. There's energy. There's buzz. We're bringing in some great soloists. And that dictates a little bit of the repertoire, which violin choice, which piano concerto are we going to be listening to. But they have to be somebody who can turn you on. It's not just about somebody playing that piano concerto. It's about how they're going to play that piano concerto. Mm-hmm. That's important. I have a real taste of music. I like certain things, and I conduct things certainly better than other things. I'm not a Baroque specialist. I don't think the Carson Center is a Baroque theater. And I don't think we have the orchestra to play Baroque music because of the instruments, the Baroque style bowing and those details. So it would be a mistake to lean in that direction. But I do think we do the Romantic very well into the 20th century, very, very well. And I have just a riot introducing our audiences and orchestras to new repertoire. Mm-hmm. I did a piece of music, it's not new, Howard Hanson Symphony No. 2 last concert. Nobody knew who it was. There was one person on our board that knew the piece because he's a Hanson fan. The audience went goo-goo gaga over this thing.
Well, what's interesting about that concert is that the last half of the program was Beethoven's Fifth. Mm-hmm. You'd think, and that's really the one we marketed heavily about, obviously. But I was amazed after the performance hearing from folks, I came because of Beethoven, but I fell in love with Hanson.
Do you also choose your selections based on your geographic location? Would, and I use the term sell, but would a concert at the Chicago Symphony sell just like it would at the Paducah Symphony, or do you have to design it differently because of your audience in a more rural area?
Yes. I think every orchestra that I guest conduct or conduct has to be different programming. You can't bring the same thing to, because A, the orchestras are different. There's different talent strengths, different levels, and then there's a different community. You have to really get a handle on programming. The hardest thing for me to do was to program my first season not knowing the orchestra or the community. It was all speculation. You know, you looked at what they've been doing for the last five seasons, so A, you get a flavor for what the rhythm was, but also you don't want to repeat anything too soon. And I saw certainly some directions and some ideas of another artistic person who had a different idea that I do. But you have to get a read on the public. And I think what it comes down to at this point, and I think Dana would agree, I think the audience will come and hear anything we program at this point, because I think they're guaranteed that they're going to receive, no matter what it is, an artistic and a high-quality performance. And I think it comes down to less about what you say, but more about how you say it.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, you had mentioned that this year it looks as though the PSO will end in the black, which is good news. Mm-hmm. To what can you attribute ending in a good financial stead at the end of the season?
There's been, you know, a lot of hard work on behalf of the board that has happened towards some fundraising activity that, of course, has added to that. But also, even before really the season started, is that this year, the first year, all seven of our subscription concerts were in the Carson Center. And yes, it added a significant expense, but also when you put all of those, it used to be five concerts in the subscription series, we went to seven. And of course, that gave a boost in season ticket sales. And then when you combine that with some last-minute specials that we had leading up to the beginning of the season, and this season in particular, the 11-12 season is the best sold subscription season we've ever had in terms of revenue, and also I think in terms of seat count as well. And so we're just looking at next year building on that success. What are the people we need to be focusing on most? And that's our season ticket holders and making sure that they're renewing for next year. And I think Raphael and I announced the season last month when he was here, and there's just a lot of excitement. We're making great strides in reaching our renewal goals. So we're trying to make it more accessible for those who want to come and have great entertainment and a great concert seven times throughout the year. And so, and really the idea is to fill the concert hall and make those the social engagements of the year.
And Maestro initially said you would sign on for a three-year contract, right? And now this is the end of your second season. You're starting your third season. Are there any contract negotiations developing for you to move on past the three-year contract?
Well, we'll begin negotiations this next year. We'll be in negotiations the entire year, and my agent's very much looking forward to that.
And Daniel Seen, this is your first year at the helm. Are you under any contract obligations?
Yeah, I get to negotiate year after year, which is great for me. But probably Raphael's being a little bit modest about this. I think it's pretty widely known that we'll be moving towards an additional contract with him and some sort of extension there, and we want to keep him here, and the community wants to keep him here, so we're very happy with him.
Well, Daniel Seen, the executive director for the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, and Maestro Raffaele Ponte, the artistic director and conductor of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, both thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chad, thank you, and keep up the great work with playing all that great classical music.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lockie is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org. where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.